Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Gary Kebble, Dean of the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He'll speak on the topic, New Media and Old Media, Will They Coexist? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 17, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen, current president of the Omaha Press Club and a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
I have a T-shirt. I didn't wear it today, but I have a T-shirt from Todd Murphy of Universal Information Services and our newest OPC board member that says, "New tools, same rules." New forms of journalism have sprung up, and what we are still calling new media are actually about 25 years old in some cases. And that has forced our so-called legacy media now to adapt or change or step aside. And the question is, what's happening to journalism and our media, new and old? Our guest today is Gary Kebble. Gary was named Dean of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln College of Journalism and Mass Communications just 1 year ago, about 5 days short of a year ago. He came to Nebraska from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, where he was director of the $25 million Knight News Challenge, a program that funds digital news initiatives. By the time he got to the Knight Foundation, Gary had an extensive background in online media. He was director of AOL News. AOL just bought the Huffington Post last week. He was founding director of USAtoday.com and Newsweek.com. Gary also has experience in our legacy media as managing editor of the Troy, New York Record and the Post Star in Glens Falls, New York. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to welcome to the Press Club Gary Kebble.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, members. I appreciate being here. It's a delight for me to be able to talk about what we do and how the industry is going through this variety of changes. One of the fun things about talking about these changes now is that even though online news sites really started around 1994 and really, 1995, there's still no right way to do these things. And that's what's fun about being in online news and digital news, that although we've learned a little bit and we think we learned some best practices, overall, so much of this field is still so ever-changing that there are so many new ways to do things that we're still trying to figure it all out. And that, for me being in the field, and I think for students, is what's really fun. Because you can really tell them that in so many things, try to imagine it and then try to make it happen. Because there's not necessarily a wrong way to do things because we haven't yet figured out the right way. And what I want to talk about a little bit, and actually before I do, I have a couple quick announcements. One is that I brought a brochure that sort of tells you some of the variety of things that we're doing on campus. And we're very pleased with the fact that we've started 10 new classes since I started July 1st. And one of these classes in particular is a group of students who are covering the state legislature, and they're covering state government and state politics. We are making that coverage available to all news organizations throughout the state. And we now have 80 clients for this six-week-old news service. So news, in particular, weekly newspapers and small daily papers throughout the state are now using legislative coverage provided by the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University in Lincoln. So we're thrilled about that, and we have radio clients and television clients, and we will be distributing multimedia reports as time goes on. Another thing that we just want to announce is that we have hired a Pulitzer Prize winner who's going to start in August, and he is one of the younger Pulitzer Prize winners ever. He's 35 years old. He's from Lincoln. His name is Matt Waite, And he won the Pulitzer Prize for his role in developing a website called PolitiFact.com. That's PolitiFact.com. It rolled out in 2008, and the purpose of it was to check the truth or falsity of statements that were made during the election, and either to take advertising and measure that against this truth meter, or to take statements of the politicians or their supporters. And it's continued to grow and is rolling out in various state. There are various state versions of PolitiFact.com. But one of his specialties is computer-assisted reporting and database analysis. And one of the things I would like to mention is that if these are specialties or interests in members of the Omaha Press Club, I would be glad to arrange a specific training session with him in computer-assisted reporting and database management. So we can talk about that afterward, but anyone interested in specific training in computer-assisted reporting, we would be delighted to help out there.
We'll talk.
Okay. My talk is billed, you know, a little bit provocatively as, in essence, will online kill print? And probably the assumption is, will online kill the newspaper? And if that is the precise question, you know, is the newspaper in trouble? Are digital media going to threaten the print newspaper? I would say the answer is absolutely yes. But I also think that's the wrong question. I think the question is, are news organizations in trouble, and are digital media threatening news organizations? Because the news organization, which is more than just the newspaper, has lots of ways to survive and lots of ways to thrive in digital media. And I want to talk about those. But first I want to talk about some assumptions that have led us to look at some of the problems wrong, I think. I think we have operated under some assumptions that if we continue to analyze the digital media landscape, the new media environment, on the basis of these assumptions, we will make some really huge mistakes now. And interestingly, we used to think all of these assumptions are right. You may not agree with my state. I'm going to state that these assumptions are now wrong. You may not agree with this, and that will certainly be, you know, fodder for questions and answers. But I'm going to talk about an audience assumption, a business assumption, and a research assumption. The audience assumption, and there are many. I'm just using, you know, these as an example. The audience assumption is that we know and have known for years and years and years that young people don't necessarily read the newspaper. But I would say particularly 10, 20 years ago, we weren't all that worried about it, because here was the assumption. The assumption was that as soon as they got married, as soon as they had kids, as soon as they bought a house, as soon as they paid taxes, as soon as they were looking for school districts, as soon as they wanted to know school lunch menus, they would buy the paper. And we were comforted by that fact. And we sort of sat back and said, we understand they're not buying now. I get it. But they will come back. And in a world where the profit margins are 30%, I mean, how can we be doing anything wrong? So we went with that. And I would say probably 10 or 20 years ago, it was certainly more true than it is now. I think those assumptions came about because it actually was happening. But I think that we ended up relying on it too much, and now I think it is simply not true. But we'll talk about that. The business assumption that has created an environment that has helped get us into a little bit of trouble is that we've always known that circulation, that what we charge for circulation comes nowhere near charging the customer for the cost of the product. And we have always been happy to subsidize the cost of the product from advertising. And in essence, then, what has happened is we taught our customers years and years and years ago that the cost of the product was 15 cents or a quarter. And woe be to the person who, you know, back 10 years ago started raising the price from 25 cents to 35 cents because you saw a circulation drop. Now, you all know better than I that if you really charge the customer what the product is worth, it would be so many times that. But we didn't really make it clear to our customers that advertising was subsidizing it and that they weren't paying the full cost of the product. They thought they were. And so that when we started raising prices, they got a little ticked off. And circulation started falling. So, and again, in a time when advertising was so good and revenue was so good and profit margins were so high, we didn't really worry about this, and we didn't worry about the implication of not teaching people the cost and the value of what we were delivering. And I mention this because we repeated the mistake when we got to the online era, and I'll explain that. Then the other assumption is a research assumption. And the assumption has always been from communication researchers that don't worry about new media being introduced into the field. They do not threaten old media. They do not displace old media, and they do not threaten them. And the examples have always been, since the 1890s, early 1900s, did radio displace newspapers? No. Radio simply increased the size of the media pie. It increased the size of the media environment, and now we do both. We listen to radio, and we read the newspaper. Did television displace radio or displace newspapers? No. It simply increased the size of the pie, and now we use all three. Did cable displace broadcast television? Again, no. It increased the size of the pie. So we have 100 years of examples, pretty much, of new media being introduced, and old media don't have to worry about it, really, because the audience simply changed its behavior and added the new medium to its repertoire and ended up using all the media and did not say, okay, now that television has been invented, I never need to use radio again. Now, things did change. I mean, yes, because of television, radio had to change what it did. It had to change the way it delivered things. Yes, I understand that. But overall, those media did not displace the older media. I think it's a huge mistake to continue that analysis in the era of digital media and in the era of the internet and online news. And here's the reason. Although that process, I think, held true for about 100 years or so, it held true, I think, because each new medium was a unique new medium and did a unique thing. And so, yes, I would not dump the radio because television didn't do all radio. I wanted what radio delivered. I didn't dump the newspaper when radio or television came about because television didn't exactly do what newspapers did. And so I liked and ended up needing what each of the new media did, but they were unique. Can we say that today in an era where we go to an online news site and that online news site, whatever it is, it could be the online news site of the World Herald, it could be the online news site of local television or national television or radio, doesn't matter. That online news site is going to have text, it's going to have video, it's going to have audio, it's going to have a photo slideshow that's narrated, and it's going to allow me to get all of that in one place. And so now, Is the online newspaper, is that really a newspaper? I mean, it probably has video on it from the local, from a local partnership with a local television station. It probably has video on it from the reporters at the newspaper. It probably has video on it from a partnership with a national video organization. It has audio. It has might even have radio stories. So what is it? Is that a newspaper site anymore? No. It's a media site, clearly. But now, because everything is there, this new medium does allow me to not use television if I don't want to for news, to not use radio if I don't want to for news, to not use the newspaper if I don't want to for news. I can go to this new medium and literally not suffer a loss if I don't go back to the newspaper or if I don't go back to the radio station, because I can now displace my use. I can time shift. I can watch things that, you know, I might have missed it on television, but I can go online and I can find that episode, whether it's an episode of an entertainment program or whether it's a newscast. So the idea that new media, don't worry about them because they won't displace the old media, I think it worked for 100 years, but I do not think it's going to work now. I think we do have to pay attention. I think online media have a huge potential to displace previous media. But again, only if we're caught in a certain line of thinking, which we don't have to be caught in. And that line of thinking is that we are a newspaper or we are a television station. I think the correct line of thinking is we are a news organization. Our brand is what's important, and we no longer should care how that brand is delivered. If that brand happens to be delivered on someone's iPhone, great. If that brand happens to be delivered in a text message on their BlackBerry, great. If it happens to be delivered in a video clip on their computer, great. Because the user doesn't care. In fact, the user probably says thanks for making it easy for me to follow the brand that I like and trust. If you say your brand is newspaper and that's all you do, you know, you're gonna have problems. If you say at your newspaper that your brand is news organization and you deliver your news via your trusted brand, which you do everything to protect and everything to preserve the credibility of that brand, and you deliver news and information to the audience where it is, whenever it wants it, on whatever device it's using, then they'll say thanks. If I, having lived in Washington, D.C. for 15 years, have grown up with the Washington Post and love it and always want to use it, I honestly don't care if I am reading the Washington Post on my iPhone or my computer, or if I'm watching its reporters on video on my computer, or if I have actually subscribed to the paper and I'm holding it in my hand. What I care about is that I believe that the Washington Post, or you know, substitute your brand, I believe that that organization is credible, is doing its credible work and its credible journalism on different media. It is maintaining its credibility on those new media. It's spreading its credibility via those new media to new audiences. And the only thing I care about is I trust the Washington Post. And because I trust the Washington Post, I believe that what it's going to give me is true, credible, valuable information in whatever format that is convenient to me. I think that line of thinking, I'm a news organization, I don't care about the distribution platform, I think that's the way to success. I'm a newspaper, I think that's not the way to success. I'm a news organization, I think that is the way to success. Because it boils down to, you have to go to where your audience is. And the audience, I mean, is speaking loudly right now, that if you want the youth audience, and you're not involved in social networking, you're not going to get the youth audience. You know, if you're not on Facebook, if you're not on Twitter, no matter what you think of it, and I think here's the key. I personally like Twitter, I like Facebook, and I don't have time to do them nearly as much as a lot of people do. I think they're helpful. I have fun doing it when I can do it, and I can do it so little that, you know, you might as well say I don't do it. Nonetheless, I understand that the people I want to reach do it. Therefore, I need to go to them, because if I'm running my business, it's not about me. You know, it's about the audience. And if the audience is telling me I'm not paying attention to you because you're emailing me a newsletter, and if you haven't caught on yet, I'm 18 and I don't even know what email is anymore, because I certainly don't use it. Or as someone recently told me, I know you're old because you use email. I was rather disappointed by that. But it was eye-opening, because they don't. You know, I mean, we're seeing this in the college. We have lots of really important information to distribute to the students. Like, you can get the Harold and Marian Anderson Scholarship, which is a wonderful, wonderful scholarship. I mean, it's the biggest one we give. And, you know, we send it out in an email listserv, and nobody knows about it. You know? If we tweet it, then they know. If we put it on our Facebook page, then they know. And actually, interestingly, if we put it up on a poster in the hallway, then they know. You got to have a mix here, you know? And I think that's what it's about, too, is knowing your audience well enough to not be so sucked in by the new media that you don't analyze what is your message, what is your audience, and what's the best way to reach them. I think that a lot of times, you know, Twitter might be useless for the purpose that you want. Or it might be the best. I don't know. But you need to figure that out. What I do know is that for many of the purposes that in where I want to communicate with people, literally, a poster in the hallway is a really very good medium. You know, I'm not here to ignore old ways of communicating. I'm here to try to figure out how do we recognize that our grab bag of communication tricks and methods is a lot bigger than it used to be. And how do I know which ones to pull out and when? How do I know which arrows of the quiver to use? Sometimes I want the red one, sometimes I want the blue one. But I need to know. That I need to do that with willful thought. And I think that's the key for a lot of this, is understand the new media, not only what they're doing, but who's using them. And in particular, if that's an audience you want to reach, then you need to figure out how do you reach them using that medium in a genuine way. And that's the other catch. If you use the new medium in a way that, in essence, comes across to an 18-year-old as a 50-year-old trying to be an 18-year-old on Twitter, they catch on to that really fast. You know, you've got to know how and when to use this stuff. So it's a cultural training, too. They have developed a culture in communicating with new and digital media that we need to learn to understand to be effective communicators when using those same media. So in other words, I've just complicated it. It's not only that you have to learn a new tool, you have to learn to use the culture in which that tool is being used. And you need it's sort of like, you know, you can always pick out a non-native speaker. Generally, you know, we can deal with the accent and it's not a big problem. Sometimes the accent's so bad it just doesn't work. So that's what you want. You don't want to have your accent so bad in digital media that the youth are saying, ooh, gosh, this doesn't work. A bit of an accent, not a problem. Let me stop there for a second, first of all, just to see. You know, I've been throwing out a variety of comments, and I've been noticing some questions coming, and I really do want to make sure that I have a chance for questions. So
we can start.
All right.
There are sheets of paper at your table. If you would like to ask a question, jot it down, and we'll ask them from up here. First one, and I'm just kind of sorting through them here. Isn't the main threat of digital media a rapid decline of investigative and in-depth reporters?
I would say, you know, the presence of digital media does not mean – there's not a one-to-one relationship that the creation and rise of digital media means investigative reporting is falling. I do think that investigative reporting is very expensive, and news organizations have been laying off investigative reporters. But what I would think is, from my point of view, a much greater threat and a much more evident reason is that so many news organizations took on such incredible debt in the past 10 years. They simply cannot service that debt. And their debt service is taking up almost their entire profit margin. So, yes, they have to lay off people simply to service their debt because they made some incredibly bad purchases at incredibly high prices when they thought that the prices would keep rising. So I don't want to blame digital media for what I think more significantly was, you know, in essence, the equivalent of the housing crisis for media managers. You know, they basically assumed that we could buy a newspaper chain. You know, Lee could buy the Pulitzer chain, and everything's going to keep growing, and they're going to have even greater ad revenue than before. Not true. They bought it at a high. The market fell out. Advertising fell out. Circulation fell out. And they're suffering. Gannett bought a lot, has incredible high debt, and, you know, has to slice its papers because of it. So I think the economic situation of the debt load really is something that we also have to look at here. That said, are digital media paying their way right now? Absolutely not. You know, and that's the conundrum, and that's the squeeze, because news organizations that get it have basically said, okay, we've got to invest, we've got to have a really good online site, and we've got to have a text feed and for football scores every quarter, and all sorts of, you know, really cool stuff. Well, that really cool stuff is very expensive. And here's the thing: by entering into that market of really cool stuff, you now are competing against the engineers who can get a job at IBM or Apple. You know, it used to be we could pay really paltry wages, particularly to the IT people, because their skills were not that specialized, at least in comparison to the specialized skills we need right now. We did not used to have to compete against IBM and Apple for the people to run our back end. Now we do. And so we're in the a computer programmer at USA Today told me one time when I was working there, he said, Gary, USA Today for you is the pinnacle of your career. For me, it's just another business. And I'm looking for the business that's going to pay me the most. I came from IBM and I might go to Hewlett Packard. It doesn't matter to me. So the new media require incredible expertise that does not come cheap. And on top of that, it's not bringing in the revenue. So there's a huge squeeze, and that's another problem. Because the other thing that we did is we made the mistake of, again, teaching people that what we do is worthless. When we launched the digital media, we really didn't know what the business model was. We just figured, it sounds like it's going to be the future. I want to be there. So I'm going to jump in and I'm going to do like everybody else. I'm going to put my content online and give it away for free. Well, what is it that I have besides my content? Nothing. And so what kind of a business model is that? I'm going to take the only thing that I know how to sell, the only thing I have to sell, and I'm not going to sell it. I'm going to give it away for free. And I don't really know how this is going to work, but I just believe all the people out there saying, it's eyeballs are important, so the number of people who see your website, you're going to get money from that somehow. And that's what news organizations did. And then we compounded the problem by saying, you newspaper ad salesperson, go out and sell the website too. Well, they didn't know what a website was, and they were being told to go out and sell it. And so they would get, let's say you could get $100 for an ad in the newspaper, and they were asking somebody to buy an ad online. They had no idea how to price it, no idea what it was worth. They didn't know what it was, nor did the customer. So they ended up by saying, well, we've got to get you used to this. Buy the $100 ad in the paper, and I'll give you the online ad for free. So what did we do? We taught the customer that online ads were worth nothing. So we gave away our content, and we said that we have our ads have absolutely zero value. And now we're wondering why we don't have money. You know, I mean, it's pretty much that simple. It didn't make sense. We goofed. And now we're trying to put the horse back into the barn. And it's working. I think, I predict, you should never do this, but I will, iTunes is going to be the salvation. I think iTunes is the salvation of the digital content industry, and I say that because it is teaching people to pay for content. Even if it's 99 cents, it's teaching people to pay for content because it's expanded it to apps, it's expanded it to books, it's expanded it to video. iTunes is teaching us to pay for content. And now there are arguments over subscriptions, and the Apple funding model is really, you know, putting the screws to the content producers. But I think that's going to shift too. But we should all thank Apple, and we should thank them for iTunes because they are teaching people to pay for content. Very long answer. I apologize.
Are you worried that new media, Twitter, et cetera, can spread rumors that would ordinarily be filtered out by mainstream media?
Yes, absolutely yes. And in fact, some of you might have heard an interview with the founder of Twitter last night on, I believe it was on NPR, but I was driving and I heard an interview with the founder of Twitter, and he was pretty much asked the same question. And he said, you know, yes, that's true. We still think it's incredibly important that this be open, that it be open for anybody, that anybody can use this, and we understand that it will be used for bad purposes, and it will be used for good purposes. But our belief is the belief of how media perform in a democratic system, and all of our beliefs, I would argue, should be the remedy to bad speech is more speech. It's not cutting off speech. The remedy to bad speech is more speech. Don't tell people they can't talk. Let everybody talk so that truth eventually emerges from the discussion. Now, I was an advisor to a group that was advising the Secretary of Defense for whether or not the military should be able to use Twitter and Facebook. And they had a closed system because they said Twitter and Facebook are open and they could infect our computers and we could get hacked and all sorts of stuff. So we will let the military use a closed system so they can talk only among themselves but certainly can't talk to their families. And with people, you know, displaced with around the world, that became a real issue. So the military actually was trying to figure out, can we, should we allow the troops to use social networking? And as I was speaking, they were in essence tweeting behind on a screen behind me in their private system. And what they were saying was, yeah, Al-Qaeda can use Twitter and Facebook in the caves, and we can't use it at the Pentagon. And they were thinking, you know, if we want to take the war to the enemy, we'd better understand what they're doing, how they're doing it, how they're communicating, how they're recruiting, which they are via social media, and how we can find out about that, intercept it, stop it, thwart it. Turns out the white paper was written and delivered, and the Secretary of Defense did indeed allow the military to use social media. The very first group of soldiers to, actually it's Marines, to use social media is in Afghanistan right now, and they're just getting ready to leave. Knight Foundation, I funded a reporter to go and study and research the use of social media by the military in this very first experiment, and how were the troops using it, how were the families using it, how were the generals dealing with it, how did it all work out. And it was a fairly successful experiment, but ultimately the military got freaked and kicked them out. But but only after the experiment, pretty much after the experiment ended. So they have indeed allowed them to use social media.
So, will newspapers and magazines die because there are not enough of us old guys?
I think we have an issue here if the survival of anything depends on the old guys. We might have an issue of replenishing here. I, you know, again, it's not from my point of view, it's not newspapers that we should be talking about. It's not newspapers that we should be worried about. It's news organizations. You know, will the news organization die because there aren't enough old people? Yeah, if they don't hire young people who get it, sure it will. But shouldn't they be hiring young people who get it? Of course they should, and they are. Newspapers get a bad rap because they initially, I think, really were slow to respond to the changes, but they have been running at pell-mell speed for the past 5 to 7 years and probably even longer. So if you go to a newspaper website right now, you will see so much that you won't see elsewhere. You'll see comments on stories and interactivity and polls and graphs and video and audio and text alerts and, you know, all sorts of things to really give a voice to the people in the community and let them use that voice. So they are really, I think, have caught up more so than other organizations. One of the things that I think is good about the fact that our industry has been so disrupted is the fact that it's been so disrupted early and first. I think we're going to come out of it. It might be another 10 years, but I think we're going to come out of it, and we're going to come out of it much stronger and better, and we're going to understand how to use all this just as other organizations are going in. You know, because I'm seeing it already. Television news, you know, a lot of the stories about people leaving media have been about people leaving the newspaper. And nothing was written about radio, nothing was written about TV. Well, TV news is in trouble too. They're just smart enough not to keep writing about it. But it's happening. That industry is being disrupted just as print has been disrupted. And I think that other industries are, just other commercial industries are being disrupted by the fact that everybody can be a publisher and the authoritarian control of I speak and you listen is gone. That world is gone. And a business that operates only in that world now is going to fail. The business has to learn, how do I operate in a world of networked communication where everybody speaks to everybody?
Since you brought up TV, there is a local television station in Omaha that is now outsourcing its newscast to an operation not only in Iowa but almost in Illinois. It's over in Davenport. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I'm not going to get the cities right or the companies right, but this has happened in particular with radio, and it happened a lot in the era where a couple radio companies bought, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands, well, thousands of radio stations. And so what happened one time, I believe in North Dakota, is that there was a train collision, and it spilled toxic gas around the community. So the people were trying to get the radio station to alert people to either, you know, stay inside, close your doors, all this and that. And the radio station was automated, and it was being run from Texas. You know, and they couldn't get the word out. Now, fortunately, I don't think anybody died, but all of a sudden it woke people up. We've got an issue here. So I mention that to say that truly, you know, absentee ownership, particularly absentee automated ownership, can be a real problem, and it can be a danger to the community, and we've got to think about that. Is there a benefit to to running part of an organization from elsewhere? Yeah, in this digital age, you can do it. You know, honestly, they could probably that same TV station. I'm just creating an example here. I'm not speaking from any knowledge. That same TV station actually could have its back end run by people in India. You know, and they probably do. You know, and the customer service could be in Taiwan, and and so some of the news assembly easily could be in Illinois. Now, that's a business model that not only news organizations are using, but all companies are using. So does it make sense? Yeah, it's probably cheaper. Is it the right thing for an organization whose reason of existing is not only profit, but also to serve the community? I think that's where we have the argument, is that how much of that should you really do? Yes, you can automate your radio station, but what about the community then? And I think that's another question that has to enter into the equation. And it can't enter in terms of any government fiats or anything like that. But we clearly have to think about the fact that media for me, media are far more than a business. And the failure of, or the disruption of the media industry right now, that's not a business story to me. That's a story about democracy being threatened. And that's what I think we need to be thinking about.
Well, right along with that, with no or fewer young people reading newspapers, I think they're missing local news and local politics. What do you think is going to happen with local politics with this young generation not paying as much attention as previous generations did?
I think we need to really check into, is the young generation not paying as much attention as previous generations did? I mean, if we look at the 2008 presidential election, there were a lot of young people very, very actively involved, more so than, in the, 76, 80, 84 elections. So it's not that young people are not involved in politics. Now, I realize the question is local politics, but it's not that the people are not involved. It's that they need to be shown, I believe, why involvement matters to them, why the issue matters to them, why things are important to them, and they need to be shown that again on the devices they use, in the way that they communicate. So I'm going to be a bit Pollyanna-ish in my belief that the challenge is on us to use the media to reach young people, because they can get inspired, they can get involved. And just because they are not reading the local newspaper about local politics doesn't mean that they wouldn't follow text alerts or a Facebook page of a politician whom they believe in.
Why can't newspapers charge for their online editions, or at least the local stories that the paper's own reporters produce?
Well, I think the key part of that question is local, because, again, you can charge, just in general. You can charge for things that people want. You can charge for things that are scarce. You can charge for things that they can't get anywhere else. News right now is a commodity. If I want to read what's happening about the budget in Washington, D.C., I probably have 1,000 news sources I could go to. If CNN doesn't have it, I could find it on MSNBC. If that doesn't have it, I could find it on the World Herald site. I could find it on the Journal Star site. I could find it on AP. I could find it anywhere. Who has news about what's going on in Omaha? Probably four or five organizations, really, but not that many. Nothing like the commodity for national or international news. So if there is a chance to charge for news, the chance is to charge for local news. The problem with local news is we still haven't figured out how do we get local advertising to support local news? Because, again, another of the dirty secrets and a wrong assumption. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would say, oh, local news is king. And you'd go to a newspaper, and you'd look at the newsroom, and 80% of the reporters cover the local area, whether it's local, regional, whatever. Vast number of reporters cover the local area. So then you get the newspaper the next day, and you look at the ads in the local section, maybe a tire ad. Very, very few local ads in that local section. The local news has always been a loss leader. The local section of the newspaper has always been the most expensive section of the paper, and it's been a loss leader. But again, when all the revenue came in, we're still making great profits, so we're not worrying about it. But local news has never paid for itself. The Washington Post used to have like 200 local reporters and about 7 ads in the local section. There's no way that paid for those reporters. But it paid for everything else. Those reporters and that local news, reading local news, the entire package is what mattered to people. So I think that one of the things we need to do is figure out how do we get local advertisers to pay for local news. And there's a lot of small advertisers that have never been given any attention whatsoever by newspapers because they can't afford the newspaper ad. Well, now digitally, they can afford it. It makes sense for an advertiser to on a digital medium to say, I will pay for an ad that targets the people within a 15-block radius of my business. And we can do that now. So we can serve local ads that make a lot more sense for the local businessman and the local advertiser, and I hope help support local news better.
How does a business market to consumers? Who reads online ads?
Businesses more and more are marketing to consumers via the social media because they recognize that a lot of people do not read online ads, that particularly the online display ads, people, if they see them, they just ignore them and they treat them as wallpaper and just, you know, it just goes in one ear and out the other. Rarely are they clicked on. But if you tweet or update your Facebook page about a problem you had at Walmart, they're going to contact you. They're going to respond via Twitter. They're going to respond on Facebook because they have people monitoring that all the time. They realize that is absolutely direct customer assistance, and they pay very close attention to that. So social media are being used to help market products a lot more, and I agree with the assumption of the question that the online ads, display ads, are not delivering what we had hoped they would.
This one really intrigues me. So many outlets, so little time to get all the information. Do you envision major consolidation of media, radio, print, TV, online, sort of as what's happened to newspapers? Most towns are now one newspaper towns. Do you envision that happening online?
I really don't know. I don't necessarily think that there will be consolidation just because there are so many multiple news sources. But I do think, I'm going to change the question a little bit because I can't answer the one that was asked. I do think that the fact of multiple sources opens up a new opportunity for news organizations, because news organizations used to be the gatekeeper. You know, I would look at all the information and I'll tell you what I think is best for you to have today, and it's this one-way communication. Well, clearly we can't do that in a world where every individual has the ability to be a publisher, to publish things to the web, and everybody's talking to everybody. So that kind of control in the news organization is gone. Consequently, when everybody can be a publisher, there's a bunch of junk out there, you know, a lot of it. So now people are saying, help me find the good stuff. Help me make use of my time online. Help me find the credible information. I think that opens up a new role for journalists, and that's the role of guide. Help guide me to the information I want. Help guide me through this morass of information that's out there. Be my guide. It's a new role. Don't be my gatekeeper anymore. Be my guide. Be my curator. Be my collaborator. Be my information gatherer. Be my tester of credible information and deliver that to me in an easy package that I don't have to work for.
What you were saying about advertisers and especially being able to target advertisers in a media site, again, with the evolution of media, will news media sites be enough of an audience aggregator, in other words, draw enough in to make it profitable for an advertiser to advertise on that site rather than using social media alone to advertise? In other words, will advertisers actually go to that site, or is there a more effective way now for advertisers, businesses, to advertise?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think right now there's a more effective way, and that is the, again, the because youth are using, and so many people are using mobile devices with location capabilities, advertisers more and more get the fact that an easy and effective way to advertise is via the mobile device. And so there are so many now services for, I'm walking down the street, number one, that my phone can tell me exactly which business I'm in front of, and that business can broadcast to my phone 2-for-1 specials right now, you know. And it can also, and then a map can pop up and say, You're not interested in this restaurant? Here are the seven other restaurants within a four-block or one-block radius of where you are. So unless we're figuring out how to advertise like that, you know, that specifically, that locally, via the local news medium, sure, we're going to go to social applications, and we're going to go to just plain old computer applications or mobile phone applications that have nothing to do with necessarily with social or with the local news.
People can now pay attention to only points of view that they like and ignore competing views. Does this worry you? But it's sort of always been that way.
I think it's sort of always been that way. I just think it's a lot easier to do it now. And clearly, yes, you know, is it easy to find and only the opinions you agree with? Yeah, it really is. But, I mean, were we always in a world where we received the newspaper and we dropped three sections and read one of them? Yeah, probably. And at the same time, let's look at the Revolutionary era. The nice thing about that is that there were a lot more daily and weekly newspapers, and they were very, very clear about the fact that they were incredibly partisan, and you knew what their politics were. And therefore, people would either buy only the ones they liked and only the ones they agreed with, or if they wanted, they would buy two or three because they would get a different, you know, a sum total point of view. But we've always had this ability to choose to read or inform ourselves about that which we already agree. And, of course, it's also human nature. So I think the question then is, how do we make it easy for people to find things that they don't agree with, and how do we, you know, I think that comes in this guide role that I was talking about and this curator role. I think that there's an opportunity for journalists there to say, well, here's what a Democrat, here's what a Republican thinks about this, here's what a conservative thinks about this, but on the same issue, here's what the opposite point of view, the opposite philosophical point of view thinks about it. The Week magazine, which I love, does that. It's, you know, it takes one issue, one page, and gives about four or five different points of view. I think it's a great magazine.
We have just a few minutes left. If you could answer this one quickly, I have the kicker in my hand. It's not this one. Having been in nonprofit PR management for years, I cannot understand the presumption that you did not mention that you did not need to identify the value of your services. I cannot understand the presumption that you did not need to identify the value of your services. You were talking about that earlier. Serve the user, but don't let the user control. In other words, news organizations have failed to really identify the value that they are to their customers.
I mean, is from the questioners, I mean, I want to make sure I'm understanding the question correctly. Is that the point of view that news organizations have done a poor job of identifying their value to the customer? Is that?
I'm not sure who asked that.
Whoever asked that, I agree. I mean, I think that if that's the question, I think that we did that because. Circulation was rising and ad revenues were rising and profits were rising. So what did we feel we had to identify? What value did we have to show them? Obviously, we were being shown by them, by our huge revenue increases every year, that they saw the value. But again, I think that it was one of those rising tide lifted all boats and covered up failures of basic principle and process and government and business planning. If I did not answer the question, is it whoever asked it, do you want to re-ask?
No, I'll ask this one, because this is the good one. Would you encourage a young person to become a journalist?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But only at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I absolutely would. And here's what I tell – I mean – clearly, Chris and I get these questions from parents all the time. And I think our answers are very similar. We tell them that what we are teaching is a life skill. And no matter whether you go into advertising or public relations, which, by the way, are growth fields right now, or whether you go into newspapers, which, by the way, are now at the staffing level that they were maybe 5 years ago. That's not exactly disaster. And, you know, particularly when over the past year news organizations laid off what General Motors lays off in a week, you know, particularly like 2 years ago. But even if you don't go into those fields, you need the skills of how to research, how to organize, how to analyze, and how to present information. You want to raise someday? You're going to have to do it succinctly. You're going to have your elevator pitch for your raise. Why are you valuable to the company? You're going to have to give a power. You want a boss to do your project, to sanction your project. You're probably going to have to present some sort of paper or PowerPoint or something to tell them, here's my idea, here's why we're right to do it, and here's why we should do it now. So those skills we teach you. And we teach you how to do that in all the media, and we teach you a way of thinking that serves you for your life. So whether or not you go into being a journalist working on a newspaper, I would say that's not the only thing we're teaching. We're teaching something far more significant than that. Or far more lasting than that.
I'd back that up with a really short story that many years ago, I had a student who I advised for 3 years who came into my office. He was within a semester of graduating, and he sat down and said, I'm here to tell you that I'm never going to use my degree. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I'm going to graduate with the degree, but I've accepted a job in construction, and I'm going to be a project manager in construction. And I said, well, congratulations. You should do very well with the company that he had chosen to go with. And I said, but you're wrong. You're going to learn the skills you learned here every single day. And I do truly believe that. I'd like to thank our guest today, Gary Kebble, from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln College of Journalism and Mass Communications. I'd also like to thank KIOS Radio for airing the Omaha Press Club Noon Forums. Thank you all for coming today, and we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Gary Kebble, Dean of the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He spoke on the topic, New Media and Old Media, Will They Coexist? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 17, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next event will be Thursday, March 31st at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Roger Dixon, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Metropolitan Entertainment and Convention Authority. He'll present a preview of the TD Ameritrade Baseball Park, scheduled to open in April, which will be the new home of the NCAA Men's College World Series for the next 25 years. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.